Day Starbucks, and welcome to another presentation from Revelation Tapes. In September 2002, I did a tape lecture entitled Who Really Murdered Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman? For the benefit of those who did not hear this presentation, although the case was the judicy at the time, among many other things, I put forward a hypothesis that has not been explored, probably for political reasons, or if it had, the general public had not been made aware of it, because the mainstream media totally ignored the relevant points that were put forward. The three principal ones being, A, the real culprit or culprits for this heinous crime could have been an American serviceman or men stationed at one of the nearby bases in the vicinity where the bodies were found. B, that Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr were patsies or scapegoats who were fit up by the powers that be. This was because of Tony Blair's war on terror and the political ramifications and possible public outcry if the contents of point A turn out to be correct. C, an expose of the use of toxic psychiatry, the side effects of certain neuroleptic drugs, and how people can be whisked into mental institutions such as Ranson without their consent, whether they are mentally ill or not, and used as guinea pigs. Since the release of the aforementioned tape, which incidentally was a considerable success, I've received countless letters and phone calls from people who were in total or partial agreement with the contents and offering additional information. Indeed, one of my listeners was so outraged that he made several copies and sent them to people he considered responsible public figures who could use their influence. As far as I know, he received no response. Another one of my listeners, a barrister no less, even wrote to the Lord Chief Justice, protesting about the treatment of Maxine Carr. He did receive a reply, but having said that, it was similar to those received when one writes to most MPs, raising some sensitive issue that might rock the political vote and put them in danger of losing their jobs if they dare speak out. I have received many such letters, which I call four-line follow-up, or worse than that effect. Before the trial of the accused, I sent copies of this tape to several people, including the editor of the Cambridge Evening News, the solicitors who were representing Maxine Carr, along with the additional information obtained on very good authority that whoever was responsible for this crime cut off the fingers and toes of the victim before burning the bodies. This was not reported in any newspapers or brought up for the trial, as far as I'm aware. Needless to say, like many of my listeners, I received no replies to my correspondence. Another disturbing incident that was not reported in the press was that hard proof that the monster or monsters who murdered Holly and Jessica might well reside inside the razor wire at USAF Lakenheath was provided at a court-martial held on the 23rd of July 2003. A military judge found against Technical Sergeant Randy Bitter on three charges of child sex abuse. Technical Sergeant Bitter pleaded guilty to carnal knowledge with a female child under 12 years of age and two counts of indecent acts with the same victim. He was sentenced to 6 years imprisonment with dishonorable discharge from the United States Air Force. Despite the fact that Bitter was convicted less than 500 yards away from the exact point at which Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman's bodies were dumped, not one British newspaper or television network anywhere in the land reported these horrifying crimes, details of which were made available in immediate press release 073103-4, dated the 31st of July 2003 at the United States Air Force Base Lakenheath. Predictably, perhaps, these frightening look-alike offences and their obvious implications have been withheld from the jurors in the trial of Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr. Now, the purpose of my previous tape was in the hope, although it may have been, that the information would be networked and might even filter to a potential juror. Whether this happened, I have no means of knowing. However, there are a few points appertaining to the case that I feel are worthy of mention. Firstly, did you notice how long it took to bring Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr to trial from the time of their arrest? Secondly, if we are to believe what we have been told by the mainstream media, due to local public hostility towards the defendants, it was deemed by the powers that be that he stands trial at the Old Bailey. This may well have been the case, but there could also be another reason for this piece of legal chicanery. This brings me to my next point. The way the case was reported in the press and on TV, to the average person who rely on their information from the mainstream media, one would assume that this was an open and shut case, and the jury would probably only need to be out for a few hours at most to reach a verdict of guilty. Indeed, when the judge, Mr. Justice Moses, sent the jury out to start their deliberation, he urged them to return a unanimous verdict. However, when the jury had been out for 3 days without agreeing on a verdict, this should have sent alarm bells ringing to any reflective person, because it proved that at least one member of the jury was far from happy with the evidence presented by the prosecution. Several years ago, this could have resulted in an acquittal until the law was changed to make it acceptable to have a majority verdict. Actually, there have been plans afoot for some time to scrap the jury system altogether and simply have a judge. Heaven help us if this happens, but that's another story. Be that as it may, after 3 days of deliberation with no sign of a unanimous verdict, the judge moved the goalposts by suddenly announcing that he would accept a majority verdict of 10-2. He finally accepted a verdict of 11-1, moving the goalposts yet again, and the couple were convicted and finally sentenced, monthly to life imprisonment and to serve a minimum of 50 years, which would make him 79 when released, if he lived that long, and max incarceration to 3.5 years. To all intents and purposes, theoretically speaking, that should be the end of the case, and certainly of Ian Huntley, and the matter laid to rest. And yet, almost from the beginning of this tragedy to the time of this recording, the 14th of March 2004, in many people's minds, from all walks of life, who I've spoken to or interviewed, from the layman, the journalist, and senior policeman, they are all in agreement on two things. Namely, that there was something strange about this case that they couldn't put their finger on, or there were certain facets that simply didn't add up. Hopefully, some of these gaps in their understanding will be filled as the present exposition unfolds. Before venturing into writing and journalism, I used to earn my living as a professional comedy magician. Now, when you see some apparent miracle that defies the laws of nature, science, or reason, you don't have to know the exact secret to know it was a trick. Your common sense will tell you this. Now, in certain sophisticated or complicated tricks, their success partly depends on most people not being able to remember in a chronological order the series of apparent innocent events leading up to the classic climax of the trick. Of course, you always get at least one person in the audience, apart from any magicians who have to be present, who is not deceived and can see through the whole charade of chicanery that leaves the rest of the audience dumbfounded. Or, as I think Abraham Lincoln once said, you can fool all of the people some of the time, you can fool some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. Now, one of the people who was not fooled by the investigation, arrest, and subsequent trial of Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr was a former Australian pilot who is now one of the most competent investigative journalists and truth seekers on this planet. His name is Joe Viles, and some of my listeners will no doubt recall it was this man who allowed me to use some of the results of his intensive research into this case in my last presentation, Who Really Murdered Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman. This same man has kindly permitted me to use considerable extracts of his material covering the trial that was posted on the internet. Before coming to this, I would like to make a few things emphatically clear. Only God and the person or persons responsible know exactly what really happened to Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman and why. The purpose of this presentation is not to reiterate any hypotheses, but to simply ask you, the listener, to imagine yourself as a juror and have the judge in his summing up, or even the defense counsel in their final speech, pointed out what is about to be related. You would have returned the same verdict that was eventually delivered in this high-profile case. So, without further ado, we will now move on to what no newspaper would print and no TV or radio station would broadcast. The trial of Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr. Progress report and trial analysis by Joe Wiles from 1st to 4th December 2003. Quote, During the last week at the Old Bailey, lawyers for both prosecution and defence have thrown caution to the wind and embarked on a dangerous series of illusions concerning both Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr. By warping time and taking evidence and events out of sequence and context, both lawyers have, by accident or design, desperately sought to place Huntley and Carr in the frame for crimes they could not and did not commit. If we are to believe every media outlet in Britain this weekend, Ian Huntley has now admitted that both Holly and Jessica were in his house, has admitted accidentally drowning them in his bath, and further admitted taking their bodies to Lake and Heath for disposal. In turn, Maxine Carr has admitted that Ian Huntley was lying and admitted that Huntley told her the girls had an accident in his bathroom. It all sounds hopelessly daring, and the media hype might be enough to get Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr a life sentence. However, this does not detract from the fact that these claims by prosecution and defence alike are, in most instances, outright lies, with a few gross distortions of evidence thrown in for measure. Conventional analysis of the court transcripts will not help us here, because most human brains do not have a built-in Huntley and Carr chronology of events. To explain this more simply, because we cannot remember what happened in this case more than a year ago, it is all but impossible for us to separate truth from lie when lawyers from both sides are deliberately warping time in order to distort the known facts. There is only one way we can prove these lawyers were acting deceitfully, and that is to go back in time to the very beginning of this case, on day zero in August 2002. Once there, we must then follow the sequel of actual events chronologically while judiciously inserting the various prosecution and defence claims as we move forward in real time. This unusual procedure has the immediate effect of exposing the shameful charade at the Old Bailey for what it really is, though writing it will certainly take longer than merely shredding a few false legal claims in the courtroom. But for those who ultimately want to know the truth of the matter, this trip down memory lane is essential and unavoidable. Most readers are already aware that Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman went missing in Silverton Village on the 4th of August 2002, an event which led to a massive search of the area by hundreds of volunteers, including American servicemen from nearby Lake and Heath and Mildenhall United States Air Force bases. During the 13 days that followed, until the bodies were found, the Soham crime scene, where two red Manchester United t-shirts were found, was repeatedly and comprehensively contaminated by searches, including unidentified American servicemen. Jurors of the Huntley and Carr trial had not been advised that the Soham crime scene was hopelessly contaminated, nor have they been told the searches included American servicemen, based less than 500 yards away from the site where the bodies of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman were subsequently discovered. During the same time frame, in August 2002, Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr went about their business in Soham in a normal manner, occasionally giving brief interviews to interested media. It is critical to note here that both appeared 100% normal, with their body language completely open and unambiguous. There is no deceit whatever in this filed video footage, just a concerned couple who knew the girls slightly and were prepared to talk to the media about the sequence of events. The court has been told that during the same period, Huntley and Carr gave a hitchhiker a lift to Soham when they were returning from Grimsby, and that the hitchhiker thought they were a little tense. Think about this one, people. Think about it very carefully. If you had just murdered and dumped two little girls, and as co-conspirators were trying to get your story straight, would you pick up a hitchhiker? No, of course you wouldn't. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, Huntley's court-appointed defence lawyer failed to bring this blatantly obvious point to the attention of the jurors. On the 17th of August 2002, Huntley and Carr were arrested on suspicion. And then, 12 hours after they were arrested, the bodies of the two girls were found in a drainage ditch close to the USAF Lake and Heath perimeter fence by police after the bodies were being found, not 12 hours before. One gets the unmistakable impression that the main players in this Home Office charade were already on the starter's orders, and some of them jumped the gun. No doubt, members of the Cambridgeshire Police Service were expected to get a swift confession out of Ian Huntley. aided by Black Bullpup's assertions that he had already been in prison for rape in another jurisdiction back in 1998. This damning information was also leaked to the juries in court in an attempt to influence their final judgment on Ian Huntley. What the Cambridgeshire Police Service did not know in 2002, and jurors were not told in court, is that after being in prison or remand for 2 months, Huntley was freed because a council video camera was found to have filmed him many miles away from the crime scene at the exact time of the rape. Ian Huntley was therefore not only an innocent man, he was also a man who had been arrested and unlawfully detained because of significant police incompetence. This time around, the Home Office was not going to leave it up to the police. And 3 days later, on 20th of August 2002, government psychiatrists ordered that Ian Huntley be transferred to Rampton High Security Psychiatric Hospital for assessment. The official reason given by Detective Chief Inspector Andy Head may someday gain a place in notoriety at the Police Black Museum in London. He, Huntley, gave an impression of not understanding what was going on and refused to answer questions. This is not surprising. An innocent man would not have understood what was going on at all. And every prisoner arrested in Great Britain has the absolute right not to answer any questions. There was no valid reason in or outside the law to incarcerate Huntley, who, as we already know from video footage filmed only days before, was a completely coherent and reasonably cheerful man. We will return to Huntley a bit later, in September and October 2002, but in order to stay chronologically pure, we now have to address other points put to the jurors last week, when defence lawyer Coward claimed that Ian Huntley had admitted to accidentally killing both girls in his house on the 4th of August 2002. Please note that it was Mr. Coward, not Mr. Huntley, who made this admission. And remember, we will be returning later to the reasons why Mr. Huntley is no longer mentally able to refute Mr. Coward. In order to gain a true feeling for the level of deceit in the courtroom, it is necessary to quote Mr. Coward verbatim, as he was addressing witness Dr. Nathaniel Carey, the forensic pathologist who carried out post-mortem examinations on both girls after their bodies were found. This is what Mr. Coward said. I'm going to put it to you, I will put the whole incident and break it into pieces. My client's case of what has actually happened on the 4th of August of last year. At the material time, Holly Wells had a nosebleed, and because it wouldn't stop, she, Jessica, and the defendant, Mr. Huntley, went up to the bathroom at number 5 College Close. Holly sat on the edge of the bath at the tap end, which is the end furthest from the door, and next to the bath is a wash place. Jessica sat on the other end of the bath, nearer to the door. Mr. Huntley was getting pieces of tissue or toilet paper, putting them under the tap to cool them, handing them to Holly, and, on his terms, getting the wet tissue to give to Holly, he slipped, and it seems that he may well have banged into her as she is sitting on the edge of the bath, and she went backwards. He has no recollection of a bang, but he does remember a splash. When Holly went in the bath, which had roughly 18 inches of water in it, because Mr. Huntley was going to wash his dog, Jessica stood up and started screaming, "You pushed her, you pushed her." And he then turned towards Jessica and, either with one hand or two, he is not sure, put his hands out towards Jessica. His hands over her mouth to stop her screaming. For how long he was in that position, he can't say. But he was then conscious that Jessica was no longer supporting herself on her feet. He let go and she went to the ground. He then turned round to the bath and Holly was lying in the bath apparently dead. He lifted Holly out of the bath, put her on the floor, looked for signs of breathing and found none. He turned his attention to Jessica, looked for signs of breathing and found none. That's the whole account as I put it to you. Defence lawyer Coward had craftily left his confession until almost the end of the working day, and basically then started badgering Dr. Carey to rubber stamp the whole thing in the small amount of time remaining, so that everyone could go home. But the mild-mannered Dr. Nathaniel Carey was having none of that. My lord, I'm concerned this is the first I have heard of a quite detailed scenario, and I would normally, ideally, want a written account of the scenario. It is going over it rather on a hoof otherwise. And secondly, I might consider such a scenario had it been put earlier by discussing with the forensic scientists involved in the examination of the bathroom, the ceiling, the clothing, and this sort of thing, because I don't think I can give it fair credit otherwise. So, the forensic pathologist in charge of the Holly and Jessica case had no formal knowledge of this startling confession, which of course he would have if the confession was real, and if it had been available to the Cambridgeshire Police Service during August or September 2002, which it was not. Visibly disturbed by this very sudden shift in alleged evidence, Dr. Carey went away to consult with his colleagues and returned to court the very next morning. The news was not all that good for the forged confession. In fact, Dr. Carey's response was blunt and terminal. In an exchange that the mainstream media went to great lengths to keep away from you, Dr. Carey essentially trashed the whole idea on various grounds, the most interesting being a total lack of dilute blood on the two red Manchester United t-shirts, which most readers will recall were planted by a person or persons unknown in the forensically contaminated Haggard building at Soham College. Mr. Carr tried an amateur parry along the lines that surely the bathwater would have washed off with the blood. But he was no match for the quietly indignant forensic pathologist. Apparently there should have been a lot of dilute blood in the fibres of the t-shirts, but alas, there were none. The Home Office should really have thought of that yawning bear trap before planting the generic red Manchester United t-shirts in the hangar bin and then drafting Huntley's confession without his knowledge or consent. A little later on, in a telephone conversation with Huntley's mother, Linda Nixon, Maxine Carr expressed considerable concern about the lack of Holly's nasal blood, though for an entirely different reason. Apparently, after resisting the best efforts of the Cambridgeshire Police Service, Huntley finally slipped up and confessed to Maxine in a letter allegedly dated 2002. Maxine was far convinced, saying, "What Ian told me, the ones with the nosebleed, the blonde-haired one, the dark-haired one, it doesn't add up. Ian told me the blonde girl had a nosebleed. It wouldn't stop bleeding. That's what I was saying. He said to me, it was nearly stopped, and they went, but it doesn't add up. The times don't add up. I mean, he rang me at my mum's house, like at 6:40, because we were already going out. What I can't understand, and yet they were going across the car park at 6:15. They would have seen Ian. This nosebleed incident, or whatever, would have happened. And if they weren't, it weren't bleeding on the camera. You know, the Soham CCTV." Maxine Carr, the unassuming teaching auxiliary, had fingered a critical piece of evidence that the police should have spotted. In fact, she fingered several pieces of critical evidence, which, in combination, punched giant holes in the prosecution and defence cases against Ian Huntley. It is not merely the lack of Holly's nosebleed that proved the point, though she was quite correct about that. The precise times are also enormously important, and it now seems likely that the clock at the Soham Street surveillance camera was altered after the event by a person or persons unknown. Exactly what Huntley's mother, Lisa Nixon, was doing, setting up her own son and his girlfriend on obviously regulated tape conversations for the police, confused me for a while, and to an extent it confuses me still. Perhaps Linda Nixon simply wanted to get the truth, or perhaps she had no choice in the matter. Ian Huntley's father and brother both worked at the United States Air Force Base at Mildenhall, the twin base for Lakenheath, and the family thus dependent on the United States of America for its monthly paychecks. August blurred into September for Ian Huntley, completely at the mercy of a bunch of unprincipled shrinks at Rampton Mental Institution. By the time of a brief court appearance on the 10th of September, the perfectly normal Ian Huntley we all saw on the video footage in Soham in August had been brought under psychiatric control, though at that early stage it was almost impossible to discern which class of drugs the shrinks were using on him. The media noticed the change, though, and reported it thus. Inside the modern court building, Mr. Huntley sits silently throughout the proceedings, flanked by security guards and a psychiatric nurse from Brampton High Security Hospital. His eyelids are heavy and his head and body shake slightly. Try to remember that this is a remand prisoner who has pleaded not guilty and whose only crimes, according to Detective Chief Inspector Head, are he gave an impression of not understanding what was going on and refused to answer questions. If you feel that you have suddenly been transported backwards in time to the Gulag Archipelago in the terrifying days of Stalin and Beria, rest assured you are not alone. That this could be done to a remand prisoner in England is disgraceful. And the reality that the British media has now been coerced into blotting out the details is frightening beyond any telling of it. So far as the lawyers strutting around the Old Bailey are concerned, it never happened, and the jurors have been provided with no details. Unfortunately, it gets worse than this, a whole lot worse. But if you are to have the slightest chance of understanding why Huntley now sits dribbling and silent, you will have to continue reading, though I would suggest you fasten your seatbelts. Huntley was given back to the shrinks at Rampton for another month during September 2002, and they really got stuck into him. Remember that just like the Gulag, there were no checks or balances, only the need to make Huntley aware of his guilt, one way or the other. The next time we saw Huntley was on the 8th of October 2002, when he appeared in the dock of Peterborough Crown Court for a preliminary hearing. Gone was the 100% normal Ian Huntley we all watched on television in August, replaced by a shell of a man barely aware of his own surroundings. He seemed to be struggling to walk and stumble as he was led out of the dock by his escorts. British girls murder suspect declared fit to stand trial, Agence France-Presse, the 8th of October 2002. Other papers of that evening and the next day reported Huntley variously shaking, mumbling to himself, shambling, nervous, quivering, fidgeting and agitated. The next day, the Sun newspaper reported that throughout the 15-minute hearing, Huntley rocked gently backwards and forwards in his chair, appearing to stare blankly ahead into space. During the hearing, Huntley appeared not to notice his brother Wayne, who sat just a few feet in front of him, wearing a suit, white shirt, a dark orange tie. As Mr. Carlyle outlined Dr. Clark's findings, Huntley held his left wrist with his right fingers and constantly flicked out his tongue as if to lick his lips. Now, according to the work of expert witness Dr. Peter Plegin, M.D., in his book Toxic Psychiatry, the references to Huntley rocking himself backwards and forwards and the constant darting out of his tongue, the twitching and shaking, are classic adverse reactions to neuroleptic drugs. From the whole range of psychotropic drugs, these side effects are virtually unique to neuroleptics. The other symptoms listed above, the agitation, the fidgeting, those are symptoms that could be attributed to neuroleptic poisoning, but also to other drugs. However, it is the continual media references to this constant tongue darting, twitching, shaking, rocking motions which provide absolute proof that Huntley was abused or even tortured with powerful neuroleptic drugs whilst in Rampton. Harvard-trained Dr. Breggin has spent the past 30 or 40 years exposing the brain-damaging treatments that make up clinical psychiatry and dedicated close to 100 pages in his book describing every conceivable movement disorder caused by neuroleptic drugs. He documents in detail the receptive tongue-darting movements, the rocking movements, the twitches and the spasms, all of which have been reported in Ian Huntley. Those who wish to confirm this information independently should visit Dr. Breggin's website at http://www.breggin.com. While it would be technically inaccurate to claim that the Rampton shrinks have completely fried Ian Huntley's brain, they have certainly inflicted a massive amount of psychological damage on the direct orders of the British Home Office. And then, of course, the shrinks might have started a panic, because members of the media were running precise diagnostics on Huntley that could not, under any circumstances. The result was that the entire British media was placed in total lockdown, and since the trial started at the Old Bailey, there has not been a single peep from any media outlet about how Ian Huntley looks nowadays, or how badly he twitches and rocks on those occasions when he is actually fit enough to be dragged into court. Because Huntley is no longer capable of coherent thought, he is certainly unable to protect himself from his own court-appointed defence lawyer. We know that his written, late October, confession that sole puzzle matching car is invalid, and not only because of the deliberately induced neuroleptic drug effects. The Huntley confession was written by someone or another who knew that not one scrap of evidence existed against either Ian Huntley or Maxine Carr regarding the murder of Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman. The confession was a cheap conjuring trick designed to be used by the media ultimately to make us believe the cock and bull story circulated by a British-American elite with its back to the wall. Where this trial goes next, I do not know, and perhaps should not care. But the fact of the matter is that I do care, and so should you. What has been done to Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr is almost too appalling to contemplate. But we are forced to contemplate it because we must protect others from identical abuse in future. There is a terrible sickness stalking the hallowed halls of power in both Britain and America, a sickness that makes those who think that they run the world actually believe that they can get away with monstrous behaviour like this in the long term. I will keep monitoring this trial in the days to come and report on it again. But in the end, the jurors may be fooled by the corrupt strutting peacocks in their silken gowns and convict Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr by mistake. If these two unfortunate people are your own mothers and fathers or sisters and brothers, would you then leave them to rot away on the behalf of a bunch of high-ranking people? No, of course not. And by the same token, we cannot leave Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr to rot either, for they have no one else to turn to. If push comes to shove, we will have to help, and that means you. Before moving on to Joe Wild's update of the trial of the 4th of December, 2003, I would like to say a few words about an article sent to me by one of my press scouts that appeared in the Guardian newspaper, probably by coincidence, on the same date, 4th of December, 2003, by Laura Spinney. It was headed, "We Can Implant Entirely False Memories." In view of the nature of the topic under discussion, I strongly feel that an extract from Laura Spinney's report is highly relevant to this inquiry and worthy of mention. It ran, "You were abducted by aliens. You saw Bugs Bunny at Disneyland, and then you went up in a balloon, didn't you? Laura Spinney on our remembrance of things past." Thursday, 4th of December 2003, The Guardian. Alan Alda had nothing against hard-boiled eggs until last spring. Then, the actor, better known as Hawkeye from MASH, paid a visit to the University of California, Irvine. In his new guise as host of a science series on American TV, he was exploring the subject of memory. The researchers showed him around and afterwards took him for a picnic in the park. By the time he came to leave, he had developed a dislike of hard-boiled eggs, based on a memory of having made himself sick on them as a child, something that never happened. Alda was the unwitting guinea pig of Elizabeth Loftus, a UCI psychologist who has been obsessed with the subject of memory and its unreliability since Richard Nixon was sworn in as president. Early on in her research, she would invite people into a lab, show them simulated traffic accidents, feed them false information and leading questions, and find that they subsequently recall details of the scene differently, a finding that has since been replicated hundreds of times. More recently, she has come to believe that lab studies may underestimate people's suggestibility because, among other things, real life tends to be more emotionally arousing than simulations of it. So, these days, she takes her investigations outside the lab. In a study soon to be published, she and colleagues describe how a little misinformation led witnesses of a terrorist attack in Moscow in 1999 to recall seeing wounded animals nearby. Later, they were informed that there had been no animals. But before the debriefing, they even embellished the false memory with make-believe details, in one case testifying to seeing a bleeding cat lying in the dust. "We can easily distort memories for the details of an event that you did experience," said Loftus. "And we can also go so far as to plant entirely false memories. We call them rich false memories because they are so detailed and so big." She has persuaded people to adopt false but plausible memories. For instance, that at the age of 5 or 6, they had the distressing experience of being lost in a shopping mall, as well as implausible ones, memories of witnessing demonic possessions or an encounter with Bugs Bunny at Disneyland. Bugs Bunny is a Warner Brothers character, and as the Los Angeles Times put it earlier this year, the wascally Warner Brothers Bunny would be arrested on site at Disney. The article goes on at considerable length, giving details of various drugs and so forth. Towards the end, Laura Spinney concludes, "The idea of doctors having the power to wipe their memory clean sends shivers down many people's spines. False memories could safely be erased, perhaps, assuming there was a reliable way of differentiating them from true ones. Although brain imaging techniques highlight some differences in patterns of brain activation when a person recalls a true as a proven true, false memory. These are statistical differences only. We are so far away from being able to use these techniques to reliably classify a single memory as being real or not real, said Loftus. Yet, that is what the courts have to do. For further reading, see The Myth of Repressed Memory by Dr. Elizabeth Loftus and Catherine Ketchum, 1996 paperback, St. Martin's Press, New York. The listener will no doubt see the reason why I've included this article presently. We will now move on to Jobile's update of the trial on 4th December 2003. It ran, Bunkley admits putting dead girls in the boot of his Ford Fiesta. However, the only problem is, two dead 10-year-olds won't fit into the boot of a Ford Fiesta. It then shows an illustration of a Ford Fiesta with a caption, imagine trying to stuff two floppy dead bodies inside the boot of the diminutive Ford Fiesta. It is impossible, and all part of Huntley's false memory syndrome, deliberately induced at random. It then continues, no hairs on Holly Wells or Jessica Chapman recovered from Five College Close. No blood from Holly Wells or Jessica Chapman recovered from Five College Close. No hairs from either Holly Wells or Jessica Chapman recovered from the Ford Fiesta. No blood from either Holly Wells or Jessica Chapman recovered from the Fiesta. No fingerprints from Holly Wells or Jessica Chapman were recovered from the Fiesta in August 2002. Formal admission by the prosecution the 1st of December 2003. On Monday the 1st of December 2003, Ian Huntley finally took the stand in court number one at the Old Bailey in London. Though he was shaking visibly and kept flicking his tongue around, Huntley managed to answer most of his defense counsel's questions, which seemed to have a great deal in common with those of the prosecution. The court transcripts show defense counsel, Mr. Card, asking an aggressive series of questions designed only to incriminate Huntley out of his own mouth, so to speak. With not a single question designed to consign this entire pack of fabricated lies to the waste bin. In brief, Huntley admitted that the two girls were in his house, admitted there was an accident in the bathroom during which both girls unfortunately died, and further admitted driving their bodies out to Leganeath for disposal in a drainage ditch. When asked if he had attempted to remove any of the girls' clothing, either on the way or when he dumped them at Leganeath, Huntley indignantly retorted, no, not at all. By his own account, he then returned to Soham, where he disposed of the two red Manchester United T-shirts in a bin at Soham College. So here we have a man without any red T-shirts in his possession, who nonetheless manages to burn some at Soham College the very same night. It is okay to be puzzled here, because we will return to this point later. When repeatedly asked if he had returned to the disposal site later on the 7th of August 2003, Huntley was very firm. No, he did not, because he and his girlfriend Maxine had gone away to his nan's during this period. No, he never returned to the Lake at Leeds site, which is unfortunate for the prosecution and defence, who already have two distinctly different access points to the disposal site, made on two entirely different days. Obviously, it would be better if Huntley admitted both. But unfortunately, the Rampton-induced false memory syndrome was too simplistic, with no leeway for sudden changes in the rigorous story. While still locked in the same false memory early in the day, Huntley also admitted that he remembered all these details at the time of the deaths in August 2002, had desperately wanted to tell Maxine about what happened, but did not know how to do so. The entire story was obviously untrue and forensically impossible, but it was what Huntley had come to believe was the truth. There was no doubting his pathetic sincerity. This talk is continued on the reverse side of the set. However, when you send it over, please remember to spool it back to the very beginning. Came late in the day, in a curious exchange that you can rest assured the mainstream media will bury forever, because it provides a startling insight into how Ian Huntley was handled at Rampton, and how his real truth was exchanged for a carefully structured set of lies. During the afternoon, for no apparent reason, Coward QC suddenly asked, whilst you were at Rampton, a period of time lasting from the 21st of August to the 8th of October 2002, what did you remember of the events of the night of the 4th of August? Huntley's reply was enlightening. Nothing. I remember that something, I'm not sure if I remembered at Rampton or shortly after arriving at Wood Hill, that Holly had a nosebleed, but that is as far as my recollection goes. remember at this point in the proceedings very carefully, because it proves that when not sticking to the carefully rehearsed false memory story earlier in the day, Huntley is still capable of remembering he knew nothing about his alleged guilt until after he was forcibly admitted to the mental institution at Rampton. Prompted by Coward, Huntley tried to explain further. I had been trying pretty much every day to try and remember what had happened on the 4th of August. I knew inside that I wasn't there in Rampton for no reason, and I knew that something must have happened but didn't know what. I had been seeing all kinds of things. For example, I had seen the girls leaving my house, or thought I had seen the girls leaving my house, and the psychiatrist said that was a coping mechanism and I was just seeing what I wanted to see. It was driving me mad trying to remember, but nothing coming. So, here we are at the very beginning of the Rampton-induced false memory syndrome. Huntley's brain is telling him that he wasn't there for no reason, which is a perfectly reasonable thought. After all, how many of us could wake up in a padded cell and automatically assume we were innocent of any misdemeanor? Then, after liberally drugging him with neuroleptics, the psychiatrist started to tell Huntley that the real truth he could actually remember, i.e., of having done nothing wrong at all, was only a coping mechanism, protecting him from the real truth of his terrible guilt. These techniques were used all the time in the Soviet Gulag archipelago in the 60s. But this time around, they were being applied to Ian Huntley behind the forbidding walls of a thoroughly British medical institution on British government orders. It is hard to imagine this torment being inflicted on a genuinely perceived enemy of the state academic, let alone a blue-collar caretaker from Soham Village in Cambridgeshire. Every time I get emails from some self-righteous, politically correct little sod saying, look, you were wrong, Huntley has confessed, I have a strong urge to throw them over the wall at Rampton to see how long they could withstand the combined drug and emotional pressure in Great Britain's new revised version of Stalin's Gulag. Huntley described this terrible combined pressure in the court thus. I say things started coming back to me after a few weeks. There wasn't just one day I couldn't remember, but the next day I could. It was very slow, a bit like a big jigsaw puzzle. First of all, I started hearing the voice, and the voice was, you pushed her. And I thought that I must have pushed her down the stairs or something. It was very difficult to piece things together, and it was also difficult at times to know the difference between reality and imagination. I had problems with imaging things, and things I wanted to see, and the way I determined the difference was that the reality, if there was emotion attached to it, it was sort of real. You could feel what you were feeling at the time. As the days turned into weeks, the crazed shrinks of Rampton quietly applied Ian Huntley with higher and higher doses of neuroleptic drugs. Remember the unmistakable media symptoms? And then those same shrinks helped the poor man to piece things together. A little bit here and a little bit there, until the real truth of his innocence was overwhelmed and finally crushed completely by a thick layer of freshly manufactured psychiatric lies. Many people have asked me why, if Huntley could be made to confess to accidentally killing the girls, he could not be made to plead guilty to murder instead, thereby removing any potentially risky requirement for a high-profile trial at the Old Bailey. The simple answer is that asking Huntley to plead guilty to murder would not have worked, because such an omission would have been in direct conflict with his subconscious moral code. This conflict is well known to all clinical psychologists. Even drugged up to the eyeballs, as we now know he was, it is almost inconceivable that Huntley would have agreed to plead guilty to murder, wittingly or otherwise, but getting him to agree that he acted as a guardian angel to the girls, i.e. helping them with a nosebleed, would have been relatively easy, but the unfortunate fatal accident slowly fell into his memory over extended time, and the shrinks were rapidly given all the extended time they needed by the British government. In true Gulag fashion, the shrinks also had another more potent weapon to use against Ian Huntley in the form of the woman he loved, Maxine Carr, who at that time was being held in a hellhole called Holloway Prison. No doubt, it was pointed out to Huntley that if he pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of conspiring to pervert the course of justice for failing to report Holly and Jessica's accident to police, this in turn would prove his beloved Maxine was innocent of any crime, meaning that she would eventually be set free. There is a little bit of the Sir Galahad in most males, and there are thousands of examples of men being killed by sword, arrow, or bullet as they try desperately to protect their spouses from harm. Fundamentally, this is what males are born to do, and the chance to save this Maxine would have been as overwhelming for Ian Huntley as for any other man throughout the ages. All of this activity inside Rampton helps to explain the inexplicable, i.e., how Huntley made the mistake of saying that he came straight back from Lakenheath on the 4th of August 2002 and immediately placed the red Manchester United t-shirts in the bin at Shoreham College. This can now be understood as a simple lack of communication between those making up the cover story and planting evidence around Shoreham and the folk inside Rampton torturing Ian Huntley. The Rampton false memory had to be kept simple, which means there was no leeway at all for complicated variations like date and venue changes. The most terrible part of what is happening today lies not only in the fact that the charade is being allowed to happen, but also that the media pack is baying for Huntley's blood, while the fancy silk-clad peacocks strut their stuff in number one court of the Old Bailey. The British media knows full well that Huntley was tortured inside Rampton Mental Institution because it was members of the British media who described his awful and unmistakable symptoms in their newspapers and magazines. All mainstream reporters have very easy access to books like Toxic Psychiatry and huge research funds to spend, where I have almost none. The bitter truth is that the British media focus is turned outwards by both proprietors and government, meaning that reporters in London can politely whine about human rights abusers in Camp Delta, Guantanamo Bay, while frantically cheering on the exact same human rights abuse of Ian Huntley by the British government in their own country. Nor do the NGOs give a damn. Months ago, I brought this matter to the attention of Amnesty International, the Medical Foundation for Torture Victims, and many other London-based charities that are supposed to care. Not one of them bothered to answer my emails, though all emails were logged as open at the other end. I will continue to research this appalling case of medical torture and injustice, and hope to post a long and very full report on the internet in the fullness of time. However, the sheer volume of documents is now so huge, and the number of people who need to be contacted in England so fast, that this task cannot reasonably be completed until well into the new year. In the short term, I fully expect the silk-clad peacocks to bang Ian Huntley up for many years, one way or the other, and I suspect that Maxine Carr will be let off with time served, because she has now fulfilled her government role as Huntley's damsel in distress. Now that Huntley has confessed in true Gulag fashion, there is no more need for Maxine Carr to be held in custody. No doubt Prime Minister Tony Blair and his government will gain sufficient media brownie points for being merciful in her case. And the folk at Rampton, no doubt they will continue to dribble down their shirt fronts, sharpen up their hypodermics and brace themselves for the government's next difficult case. Let us hope fervently that the next time around, the difficult case is either a Queen's Counsel or a member of the British media pack. Unquote. By the way, if you think Mr. Wilde's observations about the legal profession, the mainstream media, and the government tactics of being able to sacrifice anything or anybody for political reasons, or that we are living in a police state, are exaggerated or too harsh, you might change your mind presently. But first of all, with the listener's indulgence, I would like to digress for a few minutes before returning to Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr. By the way, I would like to state at this point that I have no political affiliations whatever. Now, anybody who relies on all their information as to what is really happening in the country and the world at large from the mainstream media are just as deluded or even brainwashed as those who believe that the earth is flat. This statement might sound pompous, but I'm afraid it's true. Or, if the listener will forgive my vulgarity, as a famous comedian once said about one tabloid newspaper, if you were to use it in the toilet, you would get more shit come off the paper. Now, politics is supposed to be the science of possibilities. Since time immemorial, the masses in most civilized countries have been controlled or governed by a few. which in itself is a good thing and quite necessary, because many individuals need to be protected from themselves. But let me hastily add, it is only a good thing if we have benevolent leaders and not a load of well-dressed, well-paid liars, legal gangsters or dictators who can rob, humiliate, incarcerate and even murder the ones who dare speak the truth or rock the political boat. There is nothing new about this, of course. During the reign of Elizabeth I, we had a police state with a man called Walsingham as Spy Master General. Actually, it was this man who was responsible for having Mary Queen of Scots stitched up, tried and beheaded on the 8th of February 1542. For a comprehensive account of this, see the Babington Plot. Now, political correctness is as old as the hills. Nor is there anything new about character assassination. Often by people who weren't fit to lick the shoes of those who they maligned. Giving a one-sided and oft-distorted account of history, making future generations misinformed, has been practiced since the year dot. For example, Richard III, also known as Richard the Hunchback, was a very brave man, and was certainly entitled to claim the throne of England, as he did. Why? Because his elder brother, Edward IV, was illegitimate. On her own admission, his mother stated this. Whilst her husband, Richard, Duke of York, was away fighting, she had an affair with an archer, and Edward was, to coin a phrase, the result of their love. When Edward died at the age of 40, Richard made this fact known publicly, which, incidentally, until recently, has been poo-pooed by most historians. And then he laid his rightful claim to the throne. It is true that he probably did murder the princess in the tower out of necessity to survive. It must be remembered that in the Middle Ages, as nowadays, power was very fragile and could be usurped by anyone strong or powerful enough to eliminate, by or through whatever means at their disposal, whoever stood in their way of achieving their objective. As every schoolboy has been taught, Richard III was slain by Henry Tudor, later to become Henry VII at Bosworth in 1483. Incidentally, Richard III wasn't a hunchback at all. The hump was painted on a portrait of him after his death. Anybody who doubts this should contact the Richard III Society. By the way, his alleged last words, a horse, my kingdom for a horse, as mentioned in Shakespeare's play, although dramatic, was, according to contemporaries who were present at the scene, inaccurate. Richard succeeded in slaying several of Henry Tudor's bodyguards when his horse was either killed, wounded, and fell under him. He was offered another horse to escape, but declined, and was subsequently hacked to pieces by Henry Tudor's French mercenaries. It must be remembered at this period of history that England occupied a considerable part of France. Actually, part of what has just been outlined was exposed by Horace Walpole. In spite of this, Richard III, one of the last of the Plantagenets, has descended into posterity as a bad guy, as depicted in Shakespeare's play. But we must remember who Shakespeare was writing for in order for him to be politically correct, Queen Elizabeth I. In actual fact, the Tudors and all subsequent houses of the royal family, with the exception of the Stuarts, have no right to be on the throne at all. The late Princess Diana was under this, and it could be one of the reasons why she was murdered, but that's another story. Use of the monarchy and come back to the 21st century, because I want to say a few words about another death that stinks to high heaven, and has been, according to some speculators, another political murder. Recently, one of my press scouts sent me a monthly magazine, which, if any news agent put on display, would probably get their windows smashed or even have their shop burned down. Not because it was seditious, inflammatory, or indecent, but because, like other alternative press publications, newsletters, and certain internet sites, it prints what many people think but don't say openly, except a few, and I mean a very few, courageous politicians. In short, it prints the truth. One of the many informative articles that caught my eye, and I feel is relevant to the overall theme under discussion, covered weapons expert Dr. David Kelly. It was headed, Kelly, was it murder? And ran, Did weapons expert Dr. David Kelly commit suicide, as so far assumed? The official forensic report delivered by pathologist Dr. Nicholas Hunt claims that he died of a hemorrhage after slashing his wrists, and the Hunt report, while including in its remit some inquiry into what drove Kelly to this alleged action, does not question this alleged cause of death. But some medics have challenged this assumption. In a letter to The Guardian printed on the 12th of February, six doctors expressed their opinion that Dr. Kelly could not have died in the way claimed. The writers, Drs. Andrew Rouse, Cyril Sennett, David Halpin, Stephen Frost, Peter Fletcher and Martin Binstingle, said, "We all agree that it is highly improbable that the primary cause of Dr. Kelly's death was a hemorrhage from a transection of a single ulnar artery, as stated by Brian Hutton in his report." They went on to say, "Our criticism of the Hutton report is that its verdict of suicide is an inappropriate finding. To bleed to death from a transected artery goes against classical medical teaching, which is that a transected artery reacts, narrows, clots, and stops bleeding within minutes. Even if a person continues to bleed, the body compensates for the loss of blood through vasoconstriction, closing down of non-essential arteries. This allows a partially ensanguinated individual to live for many hours, even days. We believe that the verdict given is in contradiction to medical teaching, is at variance with documented cases of wrist-slash-suicide, and does not align itself with the evidence presented at the inquiry. We call for the reopening of the inquest by the coroner, where a jury may be called and evidence taken on oath." In addition to these submissions, one of our correspondents, who has held a high administrative position in the National Health Service, has advised us that 1. Routine post-mortem examinations would fail to detect the presence of highly volatile contact poisons which kill within minutes. They act by blocking the transmission of nerve impulses to vital organs, thereby simulating cardiac and respiratory failure. 2. A forensic scientist would want precise details about the pharmacology of tablets found on Kelly, the dosage found in his body, and the likely time interval between ingestion and death. 3. The cut wrists seem quite out of character and superfluous in a man of Dr. Kelly's expertise. Assuming he swallowed what he believed was a lethal dose of tablets, all he needed to do was sit down and quietly await the end. So, did Dr. Kelly commit suicide, or was he murdered? In view of the public interest in this matter, that should undoubtedly be raised by the six doctors in their Guardian letter, future developments of this line of inquiry should be highly interesting. Unquote. By the way, this is not an advert, but the magazine, which I just referred to, Spearhead, for anyone who wants to know what's really happening in the country, is well worth subscribing to. And any details, the listener can write to PO Box 2471, Hove, East Sussex, BN3 4DT. Incidentally, this is also one of the publications of the British National Party, but as stated earlier in this presentation, I have no political affiliations whatever. Now, a few days later, one of my internet scouts sent me the following bulletin, which was posted on the internet on the February 23rd, 2004, on thoughtcrimenews.com. It was headed, "Kelly was murdered, says UK intelligence insider," and ran, "Shocking new details about the death of Dr. David Kelly emerged exclusively today on the Alex Jones radio show. Michael Shrimpton, a UK national security lawyer who was a guest on the show, revealed that sources within MI5 and MI6 are furious that Kelly was murdered. Shrimpton spoke in depth about the details of Kelly's murder on the 17th of July 2003, information which has been withheld by the British press. With apparent backing from the organisations whose members he claims to speak for, Shrimpton presented their view that Dr. Kelly had been murdered by a team of assassins, and the charade of an apparent suicide was then played out to cover this up.
speaking with impeccable credentials, including contributions to the Journal for International Security Affairs, and having previously given a closed-doors confidential briefing to the United States Senate Intelligence Committee, Shrimpton exploded the much-reported myth that Dr. Kelly had taken his own life. He spoke of the probable method of Kelly's death, the group which most likely carried out the assassination, who arranged it, and finally, where the responsibility lies. Additionally, he explained the political context and motive for Kelly's murder. David Kelly went missing on the 17th of July 2003 and was found dead on the 18th of July. In the previous days, Kelly had testified before Parliament's Foreign Affairs Select Committee that he was not the source of a BBC story which accused the government of making false claims about Iraq weapons of mass destruction. When Kelly's body was found, the British press quickly reported it as a suicide, though several analysts had their doubts. On John's show, Shrimpton explained how he had learned that David Kelly was the BBC source before the BBC disclosed this fact. He went on to explain that his source from within the intelligence community knew David Kelly personally and did not believe that he had committed suicide. After making their own inquiries, says Shrimpton, this source determined that Dr. Kelly had not committed suicide, but rather had been assassinated. Apparently at ease to discuss these explosive disclosures, Shrimpton explained that there was advanced knowledge of Kelly's death in Whitehall, but that the deed itself was most likely carried out by the French External Security Organisation, DGSE. There was no indication that anybody in MI5 or MI6 had been involved. He went further by suggesting that the hit squad itself was composed of Iraqis from the former regime of Mukhabarat Intelligence Organization, recruited from Damascus with the help of Syria's own intelligence apparatus. They were apparently then flown into Corsica 7 days prior to the murder. He doubts that any of the hit squad are still alive. Officially, Kelly's body was said to have been found in a copse in a wood, but the forensic tents were set up in the adjacent field, suggesting, says Shrimpton, that the body was found in the field. This has not been explained to his satisfaction. According to Shrimpton, Kelly was murdered because he had been talking to the press, and there was a fear of what else he might discuss with journalists. Furthermore, Kelly was due to return to Iraq and may have learned fresh information on that trip which Whitehall could not afford to trust him with. Shrimpton's appearance on Jones' show gave him the first public opportunity to bring forward his information, since the story has been effectively censored by the British press, who, according to Shrimpton, are concerned about losing the Jovial Tony Blair as Prime Minister, were they to publish details of Kelly's assassination. Blair's departure, he says, could threaten Britain's proposed adoption of the euro as the national currency. Whilst this story begins to circulate in the USA, the coverage of the UK may well remain nil, whilst manoeuvring behind the scenes attempts to preempt Shrimpton's accusation of government-sanctioned murder of one of its own operatives. Only with public support and a belief that this information should be widely known can this information be brought into the wide open and covered by the mainstream media. Unquote. Now, the reason I have related what you've just heard is to make the point that government bodies and some of their representatives can be, and sometimes are, very dangerous and will stop at nothing to silence or remove anyone who, by accident or design, thwarts their political long-term program of which the masses are usually unaware. So, getting back to the trial of Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr. In view of the foregoing, and as a hypothetical juror, would you consider the prosecution's evidence, or lack of it, conclusive in convicting the defendants? Or would you take the view that, at best, there was some reason for doubt, or at worst, the whole trial, like the findings of the Hutton inquiry regarding the alleged suicide of poor old Dr. David Kelly, was as genuine as a 1972 Rembrandt? The verdict is yours. Peace to all who hear these words.